From Virginia to Arizona, Missouri to Vermont, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Elizabeth Warren is promising Medicare for all at no additional cost to middle-class taxpayers. Is that financially possible? Jason Pye of FreedomWorks is here with analysis. The impeachment hearings are underway, but so far, no firsthand testimony that could lead to removal of the president. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The federal deficit continues to hit record highs, and nobody in Washington seems motivated to do anything about it. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine looks into the problem with Maya McGinnis from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And this past week, the nation celebrated the contributions of the veterans who secured our freedom. But we're losing those who fought World War II at a rapid rate. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The race for the Democratic presidential nomination has become a contest to see who can promise the most free stuff to voters. Senator Elizabeth Warren has released a Medicare for All plan and claims it won't add to the middle class tax burden. Here to examine that claim is Jason Pye. Jason is Vice President for Legislative Affairs at FreedomWorks. Jason, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jason, the presidential campaign on the Democrat side, there's been a lot of talk of so-called Medicare for All. What exactly do the candidates mean by that phrase?
So it basically, Medicare for All is an expansion of the existing Medicare program to cover all age demographics, all populations, and the virtual elimination of all private health insurance. So if you like the health plan you have now and you want to keep it, you can't. You will be given the one-size-fits-all Medicare plan that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and any other Democrat who says they want Medicare for All, that this is a plan that you're going to get and you're going to like it, basically, is what they're saying. That's essentially what Medicare for All means. It's just a one-size-fits-all version of Medicare that would apply to every American.
So we're essentially talking here about nationalized health insurance. And the cost of this, Jason, has to be astronomical. Has Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or any of the candidates actually put out a plan that puts some numbers to this?
So, yes. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, her proposal, she says, will cost $52 trillion over a 10-year period, which is about $7 trillion less costly than what the Urban Institute has estimated. Urban Institute, which is not a conservative think tank by any stretch of the imagination, has said Medicare for All would cost $59 trillion. And that's because that people who are entering the system will have a higher utilization of care, which means they'll use their health insurance more under a Medicare for All system than they would have otherwise. So that's going to cause national health care expenditures to rise. But Elizabeth Warren is saying, no, it's going to cost $52 trillion, which is the exact same amount that Americans spend on health care. We'll spend on health care over the next 10 years, about $5.2 trillion a year, so $52 trillion in total. And she's claiming that no one will see it. No middle class taxpayer will see a tax increase as a result of it. And that's very hard to believe at the end of the day.
Okay, that's very hard to believe. In fact, impossible to believe that the government could take over this whole program and there not be any increase in cost. You're saying to middle class taxpayers, the rhetoric from the left is always the upper 1% should pay more. So what would be the tax impact on those who are in the upper class of income?
Let's look at Elizabeth Warren's tax proposals in their entirety. The National Taxpayers Union Foundation actually put out a study about this last week, and they're saying it's going to be about $26 trillion in tax increases, what Elizabeth Warren has put forward, and that's $26 trillion over 10 years. But about $19 trillion of that comes solely from her plans to pay for Medicare for All, and that's so that will be an expansion of the net wealth tax. So she's already proposed a $2.5 trillion net wealth tax. That's a 2% and 3% tax on people who have substantial net wealth. So the 2% is $50 million or more, $50 million to just under a billion, and then 3% on people who have a net wealth of $1 billion or more. So she claims that's going to bring in, I think it's $2.5 trillion or $2.75 trillion. She wants to add on another 3% on people who have a net wealth of over $1 billion to pay for Medicare for All. So that'll bring in another $1 trillion. She also wants what she calls financial transaction tax. This is what would amount to an $800 billion tax increase. A systematic risk tax, which would be $1 billion. And these all have to do with trading, like stock derivatives and other stocks. She wants a country-by-country minimum tax. So no matter where you earn your income or where it's kept, you still have to pay a minimum 35% tax for corporations, pay a minimum 35% income tax, corporate income tax. She wants stricter enforcement of tax laws, which basically means cracking down on evasion, cracking down on underreporting. She estimates that that's going to bring in $2.3 trillion over 10 years. Granted that the Congressional Budget Office has said that that would only bring in about $50 billion over a 10-year period, not nowhere near the $2.3 trillion that she's estimating. She's also proposing, because of the elimination or the expansion of Medicare, the Medicare program, the elimination of health savings accounts and medical savings accounts, as well as the tax deduction for medical expenses. That's a $250 billion tax increase. And then because individuals no longer pay their premiums out of pocket, that means that premiums, what they get through their employer, that means that that additional take-home pay will be taxed to the tune of about $1.15 trillion. And then there's an employer tax, basically what it is, a head tax on the number of employees that that business has. So rather than getting a tax deduction for providing employer-sponsored health insurance coverage, employers would be required to pay a tax per employee tax to the federal government to provide for Medicare coverage for their employees. So all told, you're looking at about $19.7 trillion in tax increases. She's also banking on an $800 billion reduction in a defense spending slush fund, which brings the amount of revenues that she hopes to use to $20.5 trillion over 10 years, which is roughly the price tag of what she says Medicare for All is going to cost.
Aside from the fact that all of this is absurdly unrealistic, were Elizabeth Warren to actually get elected, and were she able to implement even the majority of the taxes that you have indicated, Jason, what impact would that have on the availability of capital for research and development, capital for job expansion? It would seem to me that it would really suck all of that out of the economy.
People vote with their dollars. If you're threatening tax increases to this scale, which would not just hurt, I mean, yes, it will impact the people who are higher income earners for sure, but it's also going to hurt people who are downstream of them, people who count on higher income earners for jobs. The people who are higher income earners, the quote unquote top 1%, would stop investing. They would, or at least scale back substantially their investing. There will be no benefit for them to do so, and that's going to have a downstream effect. There will be job losses. There will be other economic problems that come with this, slow economic growth, if not a recession as a result of this. So people, the middle class, will be hurt by this, and there's no other way to look at it.
In addition to that, when you look at the taxes that she wants to put on financial transactions, et cetera, Jason, a lot of times folks look at this and say, well, it's the wealthy that has their money invested. It's the wealthy that have been reaping the rewards of the increase in the equity market since President Trump took office. But is there not a large portion of our economy right now, a large number of workers who are invested in IRAs and other SEPs and pension type systems that depend on the increases in value of those stocks and the dividends and benefits they pay out?
Yeah, look, I mean, I have a 401k. I mean, people have Roth IRAs. Everybody has retirement accounts, or even pension funds they invest in stocks. That's how they bank on return on investments, so they can retire with more money than they originally invested because of all the success of the stock market. So yes, every person who is involved in either directly or indirectly in the performance of the stock market through trading, through whatever, buying stocks, will be impacted by this.
We have been talking with Jason Pye. Jason is Vice President of Legislative Affairs at FreedomWorks. Jason, tell us a little bit about FreedomWorks. Also, where can folks go to read more?
FreedomWorks is a grassroots advocacy organization. We have about 5 million activists across the country. We train them and educate them and mobilize them on issues related to limited government, free markets, and individual liberty. And you can learn more about us at freedomworks.org. And if you're interested, you can give me a follow on Twitter at twitter.com/Pye, P-Y-E.
Jason Pye of FreedomWorks. Jason, thank you for being here.
Hey, Loman. Thank you very much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on Washington. And of course, the only topic to discuss this week are the impeachment hearings. And we're going to do just that. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
So week one of the impeachment hearings is in the book. What are your overall impressions as this process gets underway?
Let's start at the day after the election in November 2016. Democrats right away began an effort to figure out how to remove President Trump from office. The bottom line is they were totally shell-shocked that Mr. Trump beat Hillary Clinton in that election, and they began devising a strategy to destroy his credibility and weaken him as the leader of the President of the United States. And so the so-called witch hunt began the day after the election. We heard calls for impeachment the next day. People didn't want to legitimize the election results. And basically, you know, you have the Mueller investigation about collusion with the Russians. And now you've got the impeachment inquiry related to the president's so-called quid pro quo with Ukraine over foreign aid being held over their heads in exchange for an investigation on Joe Biden. The bottom line here is that what we're hearing from the House Intel Committee hearings led by Chairman Adam Schiff is that really none of the witnesses have firsthand knowledge. There's no evidence. There's a lot of hearsay. You know, this is sort of like the game of telephone. When I call up my cousin who calls up his dog's veterinarian, and the veterinarian calls up the radio show to tell him about what's going on in Washington, that's hearsay. And that's really what we have here in relation to the witnesses, the so-called star witnesses that the House Democrats are marching out in front of the American people this week. So I think the bottom line is that at the time of the call, there was no linkage between any foreign aid and an investigation of Joe Biden. President Trump and his phone calls with Zelensky, he made no push for explicit investigation. And also, Ukraine didn't know that the foreign aid was being withheld when it was withheld. And ultimately, the money was released and there was no investigation that occurred prior to the foreign aid being released to Ukraine. So what we've seen more recently is William Taylor, the ambassador to Ukraine, testified this week, and Taylor himself had no firsthand knowledge of the call between Zelensky and the president. The transcript has been out there. The American people have had weeks to review that. The president has constantly tweeted that he encourages everybody to read the transcript and that it was a quote-unquote perfect call. So that's kind of where we are at the beginning of this impeachment investigation. Now, Republicans are right to criticize the media. The media, I think, has been pretty lazy overall. And really what they're doing is, in real time, following the opinions of the members of the House Intel Committee and of the Pelosi House Democratic majority. And the reality is that there's absolutely no evidence of wrongdoing on behalf of President Trump. And in our view, there's not an impeachable offense.
Despite the fact that there is no firsthand evidence, as you pointed out, all this is operating on hearsay, the media, of course, being not only lazy about it, but let's face it, it's good ratings for the media during a time when maybe they might not have such good ratings. But ultimately, Scott, all of this is going to have a political impact. And for particularly those members of the U.S. House of Representatives who are Democrats, who won in 2018 in a wave election year, taking Republican seats in swing districts, does this pose a political challenge for them?
Oh, absolutely. And here at the Club for Growth, we've actually put out 10 different ads against House Democratic freshman representatives that have won those Trump districts in 2018. And basically those ads say, we need to get rid of this impeachment nonsense and get back to work. These were members that were elected on the vision that they would be independent from Pelosi. But what we saw beginning on January 3rd was a quick alliance between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Squad, Speaker Pelosi, and all the so-called majority maker Democrats, those moderates. If you want to call them moderates, it's pretty hard to do that today. But all of them aligned, and they've been voting together, and they've been building this strategy to tear down President Trump and do their best to reverse the election results of 2016 and elect a Democrat in 2020.
Looking at this then, ultimately, and we can talk a bit about timetable, at some point in the next few weeks, there will be a vote on whether or not to impeach the President of the United States and send the issue over to the Senate. And, of course, we have to continually remind people that impeachment is not removal from office. Impeachment is the equivalent of an indictment, and there will be ultimately a trial of sorts in the U.S. Senate. What are we looking at timetable-wise, and do we expect this to be a party-line vote?
Well, I think in the House, we're at this point expecting it to be a party-line vote, with the exception of Justin Amash, who has left the Republican Party and become an independent. He's expected to vote for impeachment along with the Democrats. We'll see exactly how the hearings proceed in the coming weeks. But make no mistake, there will be weeks of hearings, and then this process will move along to the House floor. And I think that ultimately the House will take up the vote to impeach the president prior to the Christmas break, and then we will see a trial of the articles of impeachment in the United States Senate throughout the month of January.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Tell us a little bit about the club, Scott.
Yeah, so the Club for Growth is based out of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C. We've got over 250,000 members that are united in economic freedom and liberty. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is www.clubforgrowth.org. And you can check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Congress continues to increase spending even as the federal deficit skyrockets. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Maya McGinnis from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Eric?
The Treasury Department says that the United States ran a $134 billion, that's billion with a B, deficit during October. That's the first month of the new fiscal year. It means that we are already almost as deep in the red for this fiscal year as we were for the entire fiscal year as recently as 2002. And I don't know about you, but 2002 feels like it was, if not quite yesterday, then maybe just like last week. It wasn't all that long ago. We ran about $150 billion deficit that year, already at $134 billion in this year. And worse to come. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Maya McGinnis. She is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. She's one of the few people in Washington, D.C. who actually cares about balancing the budget, or at least having a smaller deficit than the one we have now. Maya, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to join us today.
Sure. Happy to join you.
Let's start with the big news this week on the deficit front, Maya. More than $130 billion in the red. That's just 1 month. And that means we're already well over 10% of the way to running a $1 trillion deficit for the year. It looks like we will hit that mark this year and probably go well past it. Was last month an outlier for some reason, or is this going to be the new normal for us?
Well, I think that what has been made clear with the October numbers, and also we had projections that showed this is where we are heading, is that $1 trillion deficits are here to stay, at least until Congress gets its act together and is willing to actually make some changes. But there is almost no doubt that we are going to exceed the $1 trillion mark for borrowing this year. And what is particularly stunning and shocking with that is that that comes at a time when the economy is doing really well. So in fact, this is the highest the budget deficit has ever been when the economy was this strong in the entire history of this nation. So we are really on a bad course.
I think that's a good point, and kind of a terrifying one, too. I wonder if you could just expand on that a little bit. Typically, governments would be trying to run low deficits, right? Or maybe even a surplus in the current kind of economic conditions that we've enjoyed for the last, 8 to 10 years.
That's right. I mean, we're a bipartisan fiscal responsibility group, and a lot of time people think that means, oh, you should always have a balanced budget. That actually isn't the case at all. What you want to do is borrow in smart ways for smart things or save in smart ways at the right time. And when your economy is strong, you would either be running a small or moderate budget surplus, saving so that you have the resources when you need it, or at least somewhere closer to balance. Now, we have a lot of challenges working against us. One is the aging of the population. And so our entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, they are busting at the seams. They are growing. And this also means the aging of the population also means our economic growth is going to slow down because so many people are leaving the workforce. So we have these economic challenges. So maybe we wouldn't have a surplus this year, but we certainly should have a smaller deficit, much smaller than what we have. But the other thing working against us is we have a broken political system. There's just no denying the fact that we do not have responsible leadership on issues when they are hard. We are competing on giving away things to voters and citizens, but nobody who's talking about how to pay for things in any serious level, and certainly nobody who's talking about how to fix this problem of these trillion-dollar deficits.
We are talking with Maya McGinnis. She is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We're talking about the lack of a responsible federal budget. Maya, you were just saying that one of the big problems with this debt issue, this debt problem, is really a political problem. On the left, you have presidential candidates who want to expand entitlement programs and increase the amount of money the federal government spends on those things. On the right, you have President Donald Trump just this past week talking about maybe there'll be another tax cut if he gets reelected. And look, I love tax cuts. They're great. But you do have to wonder about the wisdom of that when you're running these huge deficits, running trillion-dollar deficits annually. There's maybe a bit of a sense out there that this situation could resolve itself, right? Like, we had big deficits a decade ago after the Great Recession during the early years of the Obama administration, and they came down to more manageable levels over time without much of an issue. Why is it different this time?
No, that's right. We've had huge deficits like this before, but they were not sensibly, but understandably at a period of economic slowdown. They were the result and combat a recession. And so what happened was that then when the economy improved, those deficits came down. And in fact, President Obama and Congress at the time also took additional measures. I don't think they were the best ones out there, being the sequester, which was across-the-board spending cuts, but they did, and they let some of the tax cuts disappear for high-income earners. So they weren't like fundamental reforms, but they actually took real steps that improved the fiscal situation along with the economy recovering. Now we have this favorable economic situation, and we are seeing the opposite. We are seeing, as you pointed out, huge tax cuts, potentially additional rounds of them, and huge spending increases by getting rid of that sequester but not replacing it with anything else. And really what you have is two parties now. Like you said, it's on both sides of the political aisle, both sides of the budget, and they are telling us imaginary fairy tales of these things will pay for themselves, don't worry about the deficit or the debt, it doesn't matter. And these are the stories that countries tell themselves before they lose their economic strength.
And of course, fairy tales, they can be nice, but they can also be pretty nasty. And the one thing that they usually have in common is that they teach an important lesson. And I do kind of wonder what we are going to learn, what lesson we're going to learn from the fairy tales that we are telling ourselves about the debt and the deficit right now. We are unfortunately out of time for more of that, though. Maya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That is Maya McGinnis. She is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. You can find their work online at crfb.org. And when you visit the website, you can take a crack at balancing the budget on your own terms. There's a cool little tool they have on there called the Debt Fixer. You can come up with your own plan, submit it, and then Maya's organization, they will send it directly to your member of Congress. So again, you can check that out at crfb.org. That's the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Thanks for joining us, folks, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The recent celebration of Veterans Day found fewer World War II veterans to honor. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about one such loss on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Joseph G. Hurilla grew up in Sandy Lake, Pennsylvania in the 1950s. His hero was G.I. Joe. He watched movies like The Sands of Iwo Jima. When Vietnam came, Joe wanted to get there as quickly as possible. His first image when he got there were the bloated, naked, dead bodies of Vietnamese civilians. Joe was aghast as he watched fellow Vietnamese walk right over the bodies of their brethren as if they were litter, garbage. I wondered what kind of people could ignore such atrocities, Joe said. But 9 months later, as a Specialist 5 crew chief on medevac helicopters cruising into combat zones, Joe found himself doing the same thing. So much death abounded that at one point, Joe was convinced no one was getting out of that place alive. Still, the personal faith that he was meant to do something else in life got him through. Barely. Joe Hurilla became a door gunner for the 170th AHC Assault Helicopter Company. He was barely 18, so young the crewmates called him the kid. In fact, he enlisted a mere 10 days after he turned 17. He had to have his mom sign him up. The helicopter missions were no joyride. Hurilla was involved in not one, but three crashes. He never forgot the one on October 29, 1967. Joe lost his best friend, Thomas Griffey of Rifle, Colorado. He picked up Griff's body bag. That one really hit him. Joe cried only once in Vietnam, for Griff. The sergeant tried to convince young Joe to get over it. "He's only a number," the sergeant said. "Yeah, but he was only a number to them," said Joe, "but to me, he was a really nice guy." Joe would lose more friends. On November 14, 1967, his helicopter went down in the Battle of Dak To. Joe alone survived. Though hardly unscathed, physically or emotionally, he suffered spinal injuries permanently affecting his gait. His pilot, Laris Wayne Rowland, 26 years old of Portland, Oregon, died in Joe's arms. Joe eventually got home and married his girl, Patricia. They had two sons and settled in Pittsburgh. He was hired as a millwright at U.S. Steel's Irvin Works. He was racked by PTSD, nightmares, flashbacks, depression, anxiety. He wouldn't leave the house except to go to work. Joe eventually enrolled at Penn State University for a two-year program in electrical engineering. He made it through. In May 1991, he graduated, but again, life wasn't smooth sailing. Over the next 14 months, he sat through nearly 150 job interviews. It was USX that bailed him out, hired him again. He slowly pulled himself together. In 1996, Hurilla received long overdue recognition when given a Courage to Come Back Award, known as a Rocky Blyer Award. Still, he didn't want to talk much about what happened. The decades since Vietnam remained a struggle. In recent years, became especially difficult. Joseph G. Hurilla passed away on August 7th, 2019. He was 70 years old. "He struggled the last 2 years," says his son, Joe Jr., thankful that he spent time with his dad those final days, even though it was tough watching him deteriorate. Said Joe Jr., "I really got to know him and confirmed what I always knew, that he was truly a great man, who despite all the obstacles never gave up. I find peace in knowing that he is now free from all the pain in this world." Yes, free from all the pain of this world, of Vietnam, and reunited with his buddies at last once again. Joe Hurilla and each of them were always more than a number. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KKBG-FM in Hilo, Hawaii, KWJZ-FM in Neshamish, Washington, along with WMCR-AM in North Syracuse, New York. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.